Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation takes place at the 2010 Forum for Primary Prevention Advocates called Ending Violence Against Women and Teen Dating Violence. In this panel presentation, facilitated by Kathy Moore from the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence and CalCASA's Chad Sniffen, panelists discuss building intergenerational partnerships for preventing teen dating violence.
I'm Kathy Moore. I'm the Associate Director at the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, and it's my pleasure to co-facilitate this closing panel with Chad Sniffen from CalCASA. This is our attempt to kind of bridge and bring together a lot of the conversations that have been happening the past 2 days. What happens now in terms of going forward? So again, this panel is really focused on intergenerational partnerships, and I think you've heard that coming up amongst several of our speakers throughout the last 2 days. I think part of the thinking behind this is that for so long, our intervention services, and we know that domestic violence and sexual assault happens across all generations and all ages, and we've developed services for all different ages, and we've developed prevention, and lo and behold, we have staff and volunteers in our organizations from all different age groups and so forth. So acknowledging that is important, and thinking mindfully about how we work together is some of the reasoning behind this panel. And in particular, I want to point out that there is a book, and I can't remember the author offhand, called Working Across Generations. But you have a two-pager in your packets written by Lisa Fujia Parks, and it's kind of a collection of thoughts and reactions and ongoing conversations about intergenerational partnerships that we've been talking about. So I want to point you to that. Basically, we're starting this panel by encouraging our panelists to talk about their own experiences and thinking about their own stories in terms of why they got into this movement, and to point out where we have some generational differences and some similarities, and to pay attention to how power is different across our different generations and how that impacts our prevention work together. I think the other piece to point out is that we were very intentional with this panel of getting people from different ages, rural, urban, different ethnic representations, LGBTQ, and so forth. But we are going to be talking about generations and age differences. At the same time, we all know that stereotypes can be limiting. You know, none of us is one set of identities. We have a lot of different layers to our identities. And so we might be talking about millennials or Gen Xers or what have you, but we also always have to be mindful of the challenges and the damages when we kind of put ourselves in boxes and think in terms of stereotypes. The last thing I want to say is that folks who know me, who have seen me do other discussions and such, I'm a wicked timekeeper. I've already asked the panel to indulge me in that, and so we're going to be doing some interaction between the panel and the audience, and I'm the one who's going to be doing this, and I just beg your indulgence in that. And with that being said, I'm going to censor myself and turn this over to Chad. Thanks.
And one of the things I love about panels is, especially facilitating panels, is that I don't have to talk much, because it's all about the experience of our panelists. And the question that we posed to our panelists when Lisa and Kathy and I were kind of thinking about this panel was, what are your experiences from when you started in the field? And so the question that I'm going to ask the panelists to share, and I think I'll just start from the right, and we'll just go down the side. We asked each of them to kind of prepare some reflections on what their work was like when they first started doing this kind of work around domestic violence, around ending violence against women, and what are their experiences, what was the climate and the environment like when they first started doing this work, and for a lot of them, that's really recently.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Crumble, and I'm a youth facilitator at Suburb Violence in L.A. I was born into the domestic violence prevention field the year of 2008, so I have now grown to be a two-year-old in this field. Being a toddler, I have crawled to learn to walk, and I'm still growing and learning. So far, I have realized domestic violence, sexual violence, and teen dating violence is not looked on as a critical issue. Many people know it's a major issue, but completely do not understand how critical it is. Domestic violence, sexual violence, and teen dating violence have changed a lot over the years. This generation, there's a massive amount of teens who are victims to domestic violence, witnesses to domestic violence, and also survivors of sexual abuse. So for example, in my community, it goes on every day, whether it's physical or emotional. So it's nothing new to the teens in my community. You could walk to the corner store and within 15 minutes we witness a fight, or a couple outside having an argument in front of a child. Violence is pretty much a part of everyday living in my community and many other communities. So even after 2 years of being in the violence prevention field, it amazes me that many people don't take the issue as serious as we do. So I guess I'll just continue my work in this field because I know change is like close and it's on the way.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm with the Women's Shelter Program in San Luis Obispo. For me, I'm going to talk a little bit about events that have kind of shaped what it was like for me to be working in the Women's Shelter program for the last 2 years. And when I first started working there, a lot of Prop 8 was coming up, and that was an event that was pretty big. A lot of people were talking about it in San Luis Obispo, and actually, I feel like the conversations that spun out of Proposition 8 and whether people were for or against it and what I felt was behind those ideas really shaped actually how I saw intimate partner violence and sexual violence. I guess some people don't see the connection, but a lot of that just revolves around what is normative and what isn't normative, you know? We have heterosexuals being the norm and any other kind of relationships being the other when we talked about Prop 8. And it was very similar when we talked about gender roles within intimate partner violence and how rigid gender roles can really be, and adherence to that and policing that can really be a cause for intimate partner violence within relationships. And so that really, those conversations really made me think back and kind of dig my feet into my past and why some of those gender roles were so hard for me to give up. And thinking back to, you know, growing up playing with Barbies, I don't know how many people from different generations did that, or the Disney movies that I watched, playing with Easy Bake Ovens, those kind of things, you know, really shaped how I view gender and what was appropriate for each gender and what wasn't. And so that really, I feel like, caused me to open up my mind to being, to kind of going deeper and having a better feminist consciousness. And I think everyone grows in that throughout their entire life. But for me, coming into this field of intimate partner violence and having Prop 8 happen at the same time, I really feel like spurred everything on, made everything go faster in terms of my development. Yeah, so that's kind of how I began in the work and how I feel like being at this age, beginning the work now, has really shaped how I see this field. So.
Hi. I'm Sharon Turner, Stand Against Domestic Violence, and I'm I've been around in this field more years than I'd care to mention. So I'm going to start with the story, and that is that my family was one of the first African-American families to integrate Center Street in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And we had one part of the street where we could walk on. If we turned the corner, we were in Forbidden City. But being the curious child that I was, I decided to venture because there was a plum tree, and the plum tree was better than the apple tree in my yard. And so there used to be this little girl who would sit and watch me get plums that were, you know, they weren't very good, but it was the thought that counted. And she and I would look at each other, and then I'd run home. And one day, I was in Forbidden City, and I saw the little girl with her father. And the little girl looked at me, and she said, "Why is your skin so dark?" Now, I had other messages, but never in my life at the age of 7 had I been asked that question. And that became the guiding question for me. I think I'm still trying to answer. It's a spiritual question. but I say that because it was a pivotal point. And it, I then found out that I was a girl. Not only was my skin dark, but I was a girl. I wanted to play saxophone, and girls didn't play saxophone. But we had tea parties that if you were a good girl like I was supposed to be, you went to a tea party, you learned how to drink tea in a certain way, and you learned about these courageous African-American women through the National Council of Negro Women. That launched me into the civil rights movement, where at the age of 10, I saw Dr. Martin Luther King. And not long after that, the three girls in Birmingham were bombed. So at this age, I was trying to put these things that didn't make sense to me. The only thing that really made sense was Forbidden City and the plums. But I was a girl. I couldn't play saxophone. My skin was dark. And people were killing each other. But I was supposed to drink tea and become a legend for black people. I went on to college, same kind of scenario. And Dr. Martin Luther King was killed in my senior year. I went on to figure out what's going on in the world. I went around the world at the age of 23. And all of the people who said, get your education because black people will go somewhere, this very confusing time, but they gave me $5 here, $10 there, good faith people. I went around the world, and people kept telling me, I'd say, no, I'm black, I'm from a poor neighborhood, I'm in this, and they'd say, you're American. So a series of identity crises is what got me into this movement, because I'd see women, and I ask, what's your name? And they wouldn't say anything. And I'd say, do you have a name? And they'd whisper their name. I couldn't understand why is it that women around the world were whispering their name when I could say Sharon, even though I have black skin, I could say Sharon. I then went into the field of community development, community organizing. And the more that I worked with literacy for women, the more women were not allowed by their spouses to earn money. That didn't make sense to me. And coming back to this country after several years and working in neighborhoods, and then finally going on a retreat where I went to Tibet, and the women there touched me. And instead of looking at and saying, why is your skin so dark? They looked at me in fascination. They touched my hair. And of course, I had learned by that point that my hair was different, kinky, different. But they looked at my hair and treated it as if it was fascinating. And there began that journey again for me of awe, fascination with life. Fascination with what this world might be if we could see each other through the eyes of not judging because we're male or female, black or white, pink or green, because of our sexual orientation, but because we have that possibility of being human. And that's my story.
Good afternoon. I hope that you all are doing well and that you all are in good spirits. My name is Terrence Ivory. I am the Community Educator Coordinator for Stand Against Domestic Violence. I got involved in this work. I want to say first and foremost is kudos to Sharon Turner for giving me a chance because she actually hired me for this position. So readily in mind is the sexual assault that took place at Richmond High School. And I heard that's my high school over there. Okay, we have Richmond in the house. And that incident weighs heavily on my heart because the young lady is a former student of mine. And as an adjunct professor at Contra Costa College, I had the opportunity to not only get to know her, but to get to know her family. So it's unfortunate that incident was the catalyst for me to go from being on the sideline to playing in the game, per se. And furthermore, I think I am appalled and just outraged by the bystanders who just stood by. So that further gets me going to the point where I probably was that well-meaning man, that good guy, that's taken the initiative to go beyond being a good guy, where I have the opportunity to work with Stan as well as be the adjunct professor on campus. So I have that link to men and engaging men in the violence against women and children. Another reason I am involved in this work is because God has placed a compassionate heart in me, and it's just, I really love, respect, and value humanity, and I will try my best to edify humanity. So to the point where even when I'm meeting my own colleagues, it's really fascinating to me to know other areas of your life, other domains of your identity. And what I find really fascinating is our ability to take the work and create a wonderful tapestry with other areas of our life. For example, just recently I attended the Call to Men Institute at Contra Costa College, and the keynotes, I hear a few claps back there. The keynote speaker, Tony Porter, he suggested, how often is the work going beyond the work, where it becomes a way of life for you and it's embedded in your spirit? And that is obvious in other areas of your life that the work is still working. And he brought up the barbershop. I said, wow, that is really cool, because I never thought about to the point where the work that I'm doing is creating a seamless tapestry with other areas of my life that I could mention healthy concepts of manhood, redefining manhood, engaging men and boys right there at the barbershop, who the barber could be considered a community leader in his surroundings. And he has a huge impact on boys coming in on a regular basis. So it just, those are the moments that really I find fascinating about the work, in addition to job titles and credentials and experience. But more or less, it's our ability to take the work and create a wonderful, seamless tapestry with other areas of our life. So that's why I'm in the work.
Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Slaughter. I'm a consultant for nonprofits. And before that, I was the executive director of Haven House, one of the diverse shelters in the country. And for 20 years, I worked at Prototypes. I was vice president of community-based programs. And we had four programs working with youth. They were prevention programs regarding HIV. But if you do work for HIV and AIDS, you have to talk about dating violence, you have to talk about domestic violence, you have to talk about all of those issues. But I first wanted, how I got involved with this work, 38 years ago, and I'm probably, I don't think there's that many people over 38 in this room, but I'm so pleased to be here, and I saw the young people taking a picture, the youth taking a picture, and it was just wonderful seeing that. It was great, and there's so much hope for this future, for the future of this anti-violence work. I like what David said yesterday about really ending violence against women, and I'm going to say violence against women, to end it. And that's what I think the next generations have to do, to still look at this issue as a gender issue, and also to work with boys and men. But I can't forget that this is a woman's issue. And how I got started doing this work, we had just moved to California, and Haven House, one of the very first shelters, had just closed. I was hired as a consultant by the city of Pasadena to write a proposal to reopen Haven House and to try to get a government grant. And I had done proposals before, so I thought it was going to be an easy task. But at that time, there was absolutely no information about domestic violence, nothing about sexual assault or child abuse. It was a blank slate. There was just no information there. And I said, oh, wow, I got to get out of this. I don't know how I can do this. It's usually about history and experiences, how you can write a grant or evidence-based or best practices. It was none of that then. But then I decided, well, let me talk to the board of directors at Haven House, to talk to the women who had gone through the program. And by doing that, I heard their voices. I heard what they had been going through. And then it dawned on me, it wasn't those women, it was me. I was raped at the age of 18. I didn't tell anybody about that rape until 12 years later, because I felt shamed, I felt it was my fault, and I blamed myself. So I was realizing I'm one of the women, as well as in my family, my aunt And my uncle used to beat my aunt just terrible. And she was a woman that I just loved, and I couldn't understand why this was happening to her. And my family somehow always blamed her. It was always her fault that this was happening. And because of their stories and my experience, I just got hooked. And I really felt that I wanted to be a part of reopening Haven House. And then I had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C., and it was the Women's Commission, and it was in the maybe about 1976, and it was women across the country coming together talking about the violence against women, and many of them were coming from the women's movement. From that point on, it was a matter of us joining together, getting stronger together, very ordinary women, but very smart women who wanted to make a difference. So I just feel so blessed that I was a part of this movement. I will continue to be a part of this movement. And I just pray that all of you get hooked too, and you want to make the change, because there's still so much work that has to be done.
My name is James Campos. I'm a youth facilitator for Peace Over Violence. First, I want to just appreciate Lily Herrera and Peace Over Violence for bringing me here. It's just, it's a big honor for me. Coming from where I am, you know, I can't pay, you know, a $200, you know, hotel and get free food, you know. It's just amazing. I want to start off with a little quote from a book. It's, has anyone ever heard of Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll? It's a really crazy book. So it starts off with, one day Alice came to a fork in the road and saw a Cheshire cat in a tree. She asked, which road do I take? He says, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? So Alice in Wonderland had a choice of four roads, I assume, and that's where I lead off. Back, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was lost. I was confused. I don't know if I wanted to be those followers or if I wanted to be a leader. Well, basically how I got involved was I have a great teacher, still to this day in high school. Her name was Julie Berard. I was failing her class, and she had offered extra credit. So as, you know, I needed the points, so I went to this group called My Strength. At first, it was just one of those places where you kick back and chill, and I met my mentor, I want to call, Frank Blaney, this guy right here. He basically put scenarios of how to redefine what a man truly is, not how, you know, you have to be buff, you have to be smart, you have to have the money, you have to have the car, you have to have the women. Because, as you can tell, I don't, you know, fit that description. So, you know, does that make me not a man? So that's where I redefined it. You know, I am a man because I treat women with respect. I am polite to people. But I noticed in my life, my father was really, he had a lot of machismo. It's basically really, he thought he was over-dominance over women. I noticed when I was young, he would tell me, oh, you know, this is how you get a woman, you know, how to get a kiss or how to get, you know, whatever you wanted. And at the time, I was young, so I was like, okay, let me do it and see what happens. And unfortunately, you know, it was true. You know, I don't know how it happened. But I got older and I noticed, you know, this ain't right. And I got more involved with My Strength, and I showed some to my father. You know, he's a little naive or a little stubborn, but, you know, over time he got the message. I noticed that media today and life has been changed dramatically from the past. For example, a lot of rap videos in this day is mostly about drugs, women, and drug women and cars. And back in the day, there was a rapper known as Tupac Shakur. Mostly of his songs, but not all of them, was true words. They actually mean something. I found out today it was actually poetry, but he changed it into rap. And that, you know, that's nice. back in the day, I don't think people or men and women were allowed to go out at night as in it is today. You know, we as teenagers, we go at night and go to clubs. We go to, you know, movie theaters at one in the morning, right? back in the days, if you wore a skirt that is over your knees, it's kind of, it wasn't unacceptable. Nowadays, you know, I've seen the most craziest things, and it's it's acceptable. Nobody says anything about it. Technology also has changed, whereas in back in the day, if you wanted to talk to somebody, you actually have to go and walk to them or take a bus. Nowadays, you have your cell phones, you have your iPads, you have, you know, internet. We got this big old screen right here. You know, we have the technology now that we didn't have back then, Facebook, MySpace. I also found out that in 1975 in Oakland, there was a law that police were not to intervene in domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And it was seen as a private issue. Nowadays, it's more stricter. Like if a man beats a woman, they're going to go to jail. Hopefully, you know. Like I said, I've seen some crazy things. So just to finish off, you know, just as Alice from Wonderland, you know, took her road, I'm taking my road to end violence against women. My path was confused on what my role was in life, but now it's clear. I won't give up this fight.
We said this was a panel, but we want to definitely engage you for some of this discussion. I know that's hard because it's the end of the day. But we wanted to take about 7 or 8 minutes now and ask you to speak with the folks at your table. Find somebody who's from a different generation than you and share some of these intergenerational stories as well, or your generational story, I should say. So think about, you know, what was the social climate that was going on around you when you first got into this work? Sarah talked about Prop 8 happening and how that influenced her thinking about this work. Terrence talked about the gang rape in Richmond and so on. Think about for yourself, your own personal, you know, impetus for getting into this work. What was the social climate going on when you entered this work? And really then how has that, as Chad was saying, how does that then inform your thinking about why domestic violence and sexual assault happens?
I guess first coming from what we kind of talked about was how we had felt about it coming in, what our strengths were coming into, and at what time we came in. And I had kind of shared that when I was in high school or even elementary school, there was no such thing as teen dating violence. Prevention educators or domestic violence educators or anything like that. But what we kind of discussed was the strengths of our experiences when we came into it. And we really kind of found a common thread between the four of us. And that was basically was that we had strong women in our lives that told us we could do anything that we wanted to. And even though we had experienced traumas, that we brought the learning lessons and the compassion and the empathy to what we do. And how that affected how we approach and the compassion that we approach all people, no matter what their race or background or philosophies are in life, that we bring that love and that and bring that forward. So that's kind of where we came from, was we really found a commonality and a strength between the four of us. So that was where we came from.
Great, thank you. Other examples, yes.
At 8 years old, I was taught how to be a man by my grandpa. They needed a fourth person to play cards with him and my uncle. So at 8 years old, I was taught how to smoke and drink. And once that escalated going on, he would drink more, I would get beat more. Then I would see him beat my grandmother. But the main reason why I'm involved in the movement now is that I'm a result of a sexual. My mother was raped and didn't find out till I was 20 years old. And it caused a lot of grief between her and I, where we didn't talk for 5-6 years. But now that moved on into the movement, being involved with the agency and volunteered in the time in the beginning and understanding, my mother and I have the best relationship ever. But now my goal is, in life now, until I go, is that try to make no other child feel the way I felt, no other mother or grandmother feel the way my grandmother and my mother felt, and always have a place to go and talk. Because back then, which is, like I said, in late 60s, early 70s, there wasn't any place for them to go. So that's my story.
My story is, the reason I started this barely last summer as a summer job, and when I first started, I really didn't want to come, but then at the same time, one of my case managers kept saying, like, it'll be good for you to look good on your resume, yada, yada, yada. And then I I ended up growing a bond with my facilitator, Julie, and that really made me want to stay because I guess I was in an abusive relationship, too, and really didn't know, like, emotionally, and I never knew it until I really started talking and understanding a lot of things that I was told from Stan. And I don't know, like, I really just fell in love with it after a while. Like, after learning everything that I learned, I really just fell in love with it. And that's about it.
I do this work because I was in the most abusive relationship ever. My oldest daughter, she came from being raped. And I felt you so much on that. To the point where I don't take care of my daughter because I can't look at her like that. The person I was with shot me. He stabbed me. They had me cause a miscarriage. And I do this work because I don't wish that on nobody. I don't want nobody to go through what I went through, especially because I'm considered young. And I want everybody to understand that this has been happening for years. This is not nothing new, and it makes me mad when people really just think it just happened when Rihanna and Chris Brown got into it. It did not start like that. My daughter is 4 years old. I have a 3-month-old. I take care of her. But I look at my other daughter very different. I don't have it like that. I don't have it in my heart. I am a sensitive person. I just don't want nobody to go through what I went through at all. I can't be in a relationship without thinking somebody's going to hit me or yell at me or scream at me or literally shoot me to the point where I'm almost dead, where I can't even walk right. So that's why I do the work that I do.
I've actually been in this field. Well, I've been involved with our organization since I was 5 years old. So I knew about domestic violence. And still, I found myself in a dating situation where it almost cost me my life. So I know that the work that I do now, it comes from my passion. It comes from the leadership, the gifts, the knowledge that I received. And I don't want that to go to waste. So I've made it my mission to carry that same message that I was given to our new generations. And I'm so lucky to have had those privileges. I remember coming to Sacramento 15 years ago as a teen, and now I have that leadership position where I could bring, you know, teens to this conference. And so it's been such a big step, and in these 15 years I was sharing with my table, I basically closed my eyes, and here I am 31 years old, and the problem is still here, you know? So I know that, like Ruth said, there's so much work we can do, and by us coming together and sharing our stories that are so impactful, that's the only way we're gonna get across. And with this new technology and with these new words and these new fancy terms that we come up with, the problem is still there. And I think only with bridging the gap and educating our youth, but not only the youth, but the adults on how to relate and how to communicate, will we ever come close to solving this problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go on with what we're planning, like I want to thank everyone for being so willing to share your experiences. It's something that we probably forget to do a lot in this movement is that, you know, kind of the point of this panel was to talk about intergenerational communication and partnerships, but part of telling the stories of our generations are telling the stories of our lives, and you know, we probably could have all done something else and could be doing something else right now. We have deeply personal and powerful experiences that drive us to do this kind of difficult work. So I just want to take a moment to thank everyone. I don't think we expected. We should have thought that part of sharing our personal lives and sharing our generational experiences, also sharing our own experiences. I thank you for all your willingness to do that. And so we also, in this panel, want to talk about how across generations, you know, sometimes when you start from different points in history, when you start your life from different points in history, sometimes you don't talk about things the same way. I mean, we've kind of seen that in, like, I didn't know a lot of those texting thing. And I thought I knew a lot about texting. and so that's kind of an example of how me starting my life a little bit earlier and kind of being out of some things is an example of how I don't always have the same kind of frame of communication as when I'm talking to people who are younger than me or older than me. And so so as we go on, something that we ask the panel to also think about is to share some key points of advice that they've learned for talking to people who are older or younger than them. So key recommendations, especially for building strong intergenerational partnerships, because, you know, we need, just like we don't always recognize the impact that our personal stories have on the way that we do the work that we do and our motivations and our reasons for our passion, behind a passion for our work, we also don't always recognize how differences in age distribute power differently in organizations, how differences in age change the way that we listen to each other. And so we thought that our panelists could share some experiences on that, and then we'll ask you for some more experiences too. So if we could also just kind of start with Mickey.
It's sometimes difficult to talk to adults because as teenagers, we are looked down upon because we're not the same age. We haven't grown, but that's life. We are gonna go to your age and we're gonna learn those experiences. But for the meantime, you know, we're 18, 19, 17, or 16. One thing I got this from our youth track. We were talking about things that adults and young people want from adults. One of them was communication, and that's a big thing because if you don't have communication in any type of relationship, you won't, you know, get any far. Fairness, support, mentorship. One person mentioned that they had a mentor at a school, and the person was just there for you know, a couple of hours, like 4 to 6, and after the 6 o'clock mark, they just left, and they were just, you know, they're just devastated. You know, even though you don't get paid after the 6 mark, you should, you know, stay there for, you know, as long as you need, because people want that connection with you. If they don't feel that connection, teens won't want to get around adults. So that leads me to the next one. That's trust. Trust is a big part in teens that we want. We want to know that we feel that trust with you. If we can't trust nobody, we can't open up to ourselves. For me, it took me a great while to trust people, and once I got that trust, I could, you know, I could open up. I could tell, you know, now I could just speak my mind to them. Active listening, that's another key part where, you know, you could talk to somebody, but you don't know if they're listening to you. Like last, I want to say March, we went to talk to one of the senators. And we were trying to talk about our bill, and you know, he was just nodding his head, you know, agreeing. But we all knew, me and my person that was with me, we noticed that he wasn't really, you know, paying attention, and that, you know, it hurt us because we were trying to do something good, and they were just, you know, like whatever's about it. And also a big one is to not judge us. You know, we will do our mistakes just as you guys have done your mistakes. And we don't want to be judged, you know, in a way, just like, accept it. You know, we know what we did and we are, you know, we know what to do. And those are just some keys.
I hope I'm always growing and learning. I want to do that until the end. But this morning, what Brian shared with us, for me, that was just so incredible. And I knew about the technology, I know about texting, I know about all of that. But if you think of technology as a river, I heard this once, and young people under 20, they swim in that river. They are like fish in the river. People maybe a little bit older are floating in the river. And some people a little bit older are starting to get in. But then people like me, we have a toe in, we take it out, we go back in. So this new technology, and I'm pretty good with technology, a lot of my friends, they don't have a clue. So I was telling Brian that we need to be there for young people to support, to love, to help them as they're growing, to let them make mistakes like we made mistakes. But the technology is so important, and Brian mentioned like grandmothers raising grandchildren. Older people have to know the information that he shared. That is so important, especially for older people. And then I think it could be a much better connection and to really understand what their life is like.
I remember a conversation I was having with a young man at Contra Costa College, and we were talking about, unfortunately, in marginalized communities, there's a great deal of hopelessness, meaninglessness, and lovelessness in the community. And I started to discern that this young man, being a student leader on campus, that he was losing some hope about ending violence in the community, and we were also talking about agents of social transformation, and I remember sharing with him an illustrative example of social transformation. And I shared with him the tadpole that's in the murky waters, faced with many challenges to become a toad or a frog. And I asked him, I said, so the tadpole eventually evolves into what? And he said, the frog. I said, so the frog, the tadpole changes. He said, yes. And I asked him, I said, well, what else changed? And then he paused and he thought about it, and then he shared with me his environment changed as well. So I felt as if I was able to give him words of encouragement, give him some sense of hope, and I think that's well needed. And when we partner with the community, I know we have our agenda, we have our mission, but at the same time, it's critical that we partner with the community. And in partnering with the community, we're not trying to change them as much as enhance what they already have going on. And we also have to couple that with hope. I think that the work that we in can be daunting. I mean, it's so many stories, it's so much pain, it's so much healing that needs to take place, and we have to couple the mission with hope. So I wanted to share that with you all.
Last week there was a verdict, and the city of Oakland, where I live, was preparing for any number of reactions. And while there was a bit of a ruckus, it was interesting that most of the people who were involved in the ruckus were not the anticipated youth of Oakland. In fact, what was happening in that city is that there were a number of what I call listening circles, where the pain of the hour could get out and people could drum, they could talk, they could they could express their anger. I have to remember in intergenerational partnerships that I was once that angry person as a youth. And I think, you know, as I think about recommendations, we have to remember where we have come from. That is that we once had that same passion. We wanted to, well, I wanted to save the world right then, right now. It's only going to take a day because the adults weren't doing it right. I was there. And what I've discovered is that this is lifelong. And so if there's anything that we have to work with around intergenerations is that ability to listen and sit, to have the pain. Why is this taking the pain, and why does this take so long? But to also to allow, if you will, the past to inform, not dictate, but inform the future. So as an elder, what I can give as an intergenerational person, I guess that's what you call it, leadership, whatever, is in that listening circle is my story of what my pain was like and how, because of that pain and because I still had a little bit of hope and that a lot of us had a little bit of hope, that things are here for them to take on.
I have been involved in an intergenerational mentorship for quite a while. And she's a lady that's quite a bit older than me. She's in her 60s, and she has a doctorate in feminist theology. And I have to say, I think one of my strongest recommendations is for people to be in relationships that are intergenerational in your personal life, because I really do believe that you take that to work with you. Just like how, you know, you take your relationships to work with you if they're healthy or not, right? And through our conversations, I've really learned that my work today really stands on the back of work that's been done previous to me. You know, work that's been done 10, 20, 30, 60 years ago, really dating back to Seneca Falls, you know, in the 1800s or whatnot. And it's hard for me to remember that. And it's hard for me to be grateful for what's been done already so that my work can stand on the back of that. And so it really helps me to appreciate people who have been in the movement for a really long time. And I think that sometimes being young, it can be frustrating, you know, especially with, I feel like I'm constantly working with technology stuff at my agency, you know. If someone doesn't know how to make labels, they say, oh, Sarah can do it, you know. and, you know, and after that happens quite a bit, you know, you begin to feel kind of like a glorified intern. It's like, why did I not get my master's and make labels instead, you know? Does that make sense? So I would encourage you to not only have relationships with people who are different ages in your personal life, but also to ask people who are different ages than you within your agency, you know, how are you doing? What is it like? What is your story? Why are you here? Because really there's a lot of other things I could have done. I graduated magna cum laude. I had scholarships to get my master's in economics, but I chose this field instead. And there's reasons why I did that. And I'm happy to make labels. I'm happy to, you know, support whatever way I can support. But I have ideas too. You know, I have things I want to say besides what font do you want your label to be in. I would just encourage you to do that. So I think it would grow both of you. I think it would give the other person a voice, and I think it would teach you something as well.
I guess after these 2 days, I guess what I recommend to the youth is to be straightforward with adults, because I know I used to be intimidated because, like, it's adults. I don't want to say the wrong thing. So half of the time, I used to tell them, like, what they want to hear. They'd ask me a question. I'm like, well, they really don't want to know how I feel. They really looking for this response. So we'll just tell them that response just to make them happy and to go about their day. And I guess what I recommend to the adults is because, like, especially in high school, we get a whole lot of agencies coming in, and they'll be there for like a week, and we get the surveys, and we fill the surveys out, and they ask for opinions, and we like, okay, and then they'll just disappear. So I guess what, if you're trying to work with youth and be more engaging, I say that to be stable. Don't just come and leave, or if you know you won't be there for a long amount of time, let them know up front instead of just leaving without
wonderful pearls of wisdom here. Thank you all. And so similarly, tell us your experiences working with people from other generations. What have you learned in working with people from other generations? What have you learned about them, and what have you learned about yourself and how you've needed to change or adapt the way you interact in order to be effective working with people from other generations?
I have this friend because I sit on the Aging Commission, and I've been doing this work for 20 years. Well, my friend is 98 years old, and I have this phobia about computers and stuff. I mean, it's been 20 years, and it's one of my fears because I'm so afraid I'm going to totally ruin it, lose a program, lose all my work. So I have this friend who's 98 years old who knows how to do all that stuff. I mean, she's in the river, she is swimming, and so I just say to myself, okay, my toes have to get all the way in, put my foot in, put my ankle in, and I think what I've learned about the intergenerational communication is, and I also have done a lot of foster care, so I probably had like a few dozen kids in and out of my house, and what I've learned is you have to be willing to really listen and to respect where they're coming from and take people for where they are at that moment. And I just have kind of gone with the old philosophy, everyone is doing the best they can at that given time. Mm. And to really listen and be where they're at and not where I'm at if I want to make a connection with them.
So I feel very honored to work with young people, and I think the thing that I always keep in mind is that they're more of my teacher than I'm their teacher, and I try to convey that in the work that I do and just valuing everything that they do. I mean, I'm very honored to have two of my young people here today, and the wisdom that they bring to the works, particularly as it relates to teen dating violence. And so I'm just very clear with that, with my staff, with my supervisors, and certainly with my young people, and just honoring the place where they are.
Mm-hmm. And how do you demonstrate that?
Listening to them and letting them take the lead in many things and taking a step back, mm-hmm. and recognizing that I don't have the best ideas, and actually saying that. You know, I think I said that today in the youth track. You know, I'm in my 30s. I was a teenager once. I didn't have the internet when I was a teenager, so things look different. And I certainly think that we can have a commonality of experience, like Sharon was saying, like, you know, we had certain anger when we were youth or anything like that, whatever it may be, because we're humans and we all live in the human condition. But the here and the now, the reality that exists for people, I don't go to high school every day. I don't know what that's like.
Hi, my name's Todd. There's just a couple of quick things. One is I always try to acknowledge how much truly harder I think it is now for the youth than it was for us. The conversation about having to actually walk to someone to speak to them was a great comment, versus how quick things move today, the pressures that they're under, the damage that can be done to a reputation by a single text or a single post. That didn't exist in my day. I had to go by word of mouth or snail mail or however you want to call it. I think that goes to relevance. And a lot of what they're experiencing today wasn't relevant back in my day because it didn't exist. And the things that remain relevant are how I feel about equality, how I feel about respect, not just for women, but for men, for of all genders, creed, race, whatever. That has always and will always remain relevant, no matter what generation you're part of. And that's a great place to be. And the last thing is, too, to always, I think, to walk the walk, because we're asking these kids oftentimes to walk a tightrope. And it's a dangerous, dangerous fall they may take. And to always acknowledge that and praise them for that and continue to walk the walk, whether it be standing up and speaking out as we're asking them to do so, or continuing to educate ourselves like we're asking them to do. So those are some things that I think cross-generation and are very important to remember.
Hi, my name's Kavita. I'm actually the second youngest person in my agency, and we're not a big agency. And so everyone's older than me and has been around for a lot longer. And so what I've realized coming into it only about a year ago is that I don't know as much as they do, and I should sit back and listen sometimes. And so some of my ideas sound really great, and I pitch them to my agency, and I say, yeah, we can totally do this. And they'll come back and say, well, you know, the history of our agency is this, or we've done this in the past and it hasn't worked so well, or there's been these barriers in the past. And it's really important for us as young people to realize that it's not that we're always inventing new things. Sometimes they've already tried it and it failed and we didn't realize that. And so we really have to kind of listen and look to our mentors for that guidance and not just think of ourselves as these new, innovative, young people that we are, but not just see ourselves as that, but also see ourselves in this machine that's been working for so long, and now we're sort of adding to it. So.
There's the flip side to that, too. I actually have to watch my body language because I have wonderful young staff who are excited and interested about an idea, and I don't want to have the rolling the eyes, oh my God, we tried that. Because you don't want to, it has to be a cross-fertilization.
Yes. Yes.
There's always nuances that are going to be exciting. And what failed 15 years ago, absolutely maybe the timing was off. So it's the flip side of that. Both sides have to listen.
I just wanted to say that one of the other things I've learned in working in intergenerational partnerships and organizations is that no matter what good intentions we might have as an individual, we're all living in a world that is set up for adults. And, you know, whether or not you relate to the term adultism, it's a very real thing in our world, just as racism is a very real thing in our world. And so I think as adults, we really need to do our own work to really check ourselves that we have a lot more power than young people. And what does that mean on an, you asked about institutional level or on an organizational level. I mean, in the youth track, you know, we talked a little bit about kind of tokenism or, you know, when they ask for our, you know, the young people are saying when they ask for our opinion, but then they don't really take it seriously or they don't really stay around to find out what we're really saying. So I just think it's hard work, especially because the adultism and the power is so set up to favor adults over young people. So I really challenge all of us who are adults to check ourselves and to be open, because I've seen it also happen where adults get really defensive or shut down if somebody starts saying, this is not right, this is not set up for young people, but that's the reality. So I want us to all check ourselves.
Well, I think for the future in trying to promote the intergenerational cooperation that we're talking about now, when we look at funding rape prevention education programs that are geared toward teen violence prevention, that included should be funding for a teen to act as a consultant. And I think to promote that kind of partnership is that their input should be seen as valuable as our positions, and there should be funding and support in those grants for encouraging to have that intergenerational partnership.
There is a generation missing in our work, and that generation that's missing is, you can see a really distinct age gap between the leadership in our field and the folks that are coming into positions around prevention, et cetera. And part of that has been that there just hasn't been the sustained funding to permit leadership to grow more and more positions within our organizations, and so there's like, structurally there's something that as a group of folks that are concerned about this, we really need to make more space for folks to come up, and we also need to make space for folks that have been up to transition into spaces where they're still really important to the work, but not stuck because they're so desperate to find folks to take their roles and positions.
So to get a few more hands raised, we're gonna pose one last question for anyone, of course, you know, who hears the question. And that is, given everything that you've learned from the last 2 days and everything that we've talked about on the panel, how do you intend to carry this work forward, either, you know, the work of increasing intergenerational communication in your organization, or, you know, how is your work going to change when you get back when you get back home? So that's kind of an open question, both related to specifically to this conversation of how do we carry this forward, and do more to work more in more communicatively between generations, but also, like, what did you get from the conference, basically, is what we're asking. Like, what's your big takeaway from the conference? So I was wondering if anyone's willing to reflect on that.
So I have a daughter who's 4, and we just came back from camp, and she's super introverted. She's really shy. If she gets in front of people, she just becomes a noodle. She just goes... But we were at camp, and she got a chance to perform, and so she really likes to have a chance on the microphone. So she was like, I got a chance on the microphone. I got a chance. Or who wants to turn on the microphone?
I got a chance on the microphone. No, okay. So one of the things that it just kind of affirmed what I already suspected, I was invited to speak at a teen conference just about a month and a half ago, and I really felt that I was, oh, she wants me to stand up. I really felt like I was at an age where I was no longer relevant. So I felt that for the first time talking to a teen audience. It was all teens, and it was led by a teenager, and she invited me to speak. And I was at that age now that I was more like mom, right? So they're no longer in tune. And it really occurred to me that I needed to educate more teens, more teen advocates. I work with the faith-based community. And so there is a pool of folks that I can tap on, but this conference really helped me to see that it really affirmed what I already suspected, that I need to get more teens involved in the work and they need to be more peer advocates. And so I've connected with a couple of people here that do have peer-to-peer programs going on. The generational gap was really painted really very finely by Brian this afternoon. That really helped me to know that that's got to be a part of my program moving forward.
You know, to tell you the truth, I had fun this past 2 days. I met a lot of cool people from Oakland, from Ridgemont. You know, I am going to go to Oakland pretty soon. We did this little activity about, oh, you know, if they use $10,000, you know, what would you do for music or what would you do in a web? And, you know, it got me thinking, you know, $10,000 is a lot of money, but you don't have to make a concert with money. You know, you could ask for donations, you could ask for all this stuff. So it kind of popped out a lot of ideas. One of them was actually a poetry slam. That kind of got me thinking because at my old high school, there was a big part that they did poetry. And they did some did freestyle, some, you know, wrote, and it was beautiful. So I'm thinking of, you know, maybe getting that back in track when we do our activities such as Venom Day and things like that. So
this is a quote by Dr. King that has resonated with me throughout these past couple of days, and it's that in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends.
One of the reasons why I really enjoy working with youth is that they have such an amazing ability to integrate fun and fellowship with work. And I've just had a lot of individual conversations with folks here that are stuck off in some rural county and they're the only one doing this thing. And this guy's stuck over here. And just the fact that we could sit at a table for 7 minutes and talk with each other, encourage one another, that was a very powerful and profound thing. So I guess what I'm trying to think of is ways to maintain those types of relationships, to integrate the mutual encouragement and fellowship that we need to continue to do this work. Because for those of you who went to David Lee's presentation, the silos apply to, you know, various forms of programming, but it also applies to our own lives. We kind of got siloed lives, especially in this work. So I think any way, shape, or form that we can try and break that down and just be people with each other versus, oh, yes, I direct this and I do that. You know, we just got to loosen up a little bit and have some fun, chill, talk, and do the work. It'll enhance the work.
To me, it was thrilling. I'm sitting at a table and everybody was younger and is younger than I am. And as I had mentioned to David, it's been a little while since I've been to a conference. And it used to be where most people were my age or a little bit younger. I personally had sort of given up a little bit of hope in saying, now what's going to happen? What is going to happen? When I, you know, pass the wand on, where is it going to go? And I was really deeply concerned. And I'm thrilled today, absolutely thrilled, to see so many young people. Or even if they're not young as the youngest people, they're still younger than I am, okay? Everyone's younger than I am, okay? So it's been really exciting for me to see that. I do a peer counseling thing on top of everything else I do, and I've decided to go back and have my peer counselors pick out the curriculum that they would like to see in the schools and have a real conversation instead of me being the adult and doing it. We had given a lot of opportunity to get ideas for different curriculums. So I'm going to pass the wand on to them and say, what would you like to see in the school happening? And then how about you co-presenting?
Well, I want to thank you all for sharing your stories, your experiences, and your personal wisdom. Particularly want to thank Kel and Sarah and Sharon and Terrence and Ruth and James and Chad as well for bringing all of this forward.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CALCASA.org.